My name is Clancy Imeslin. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here today. This is really an unexpected pleasure to hear the Reverend. In my misspent life, I've had many clergymen after me. This is the first time I've ever been after one. And we are certainly going to hear the other end of the spectrum. You're not going to hear from a workaholic today. I really enjoyed what he had to say, and I really understood what he was saying very much, and I appreciate his efforts to identify with the AA program. The saddest thing about this thing, however, just to get off in a moment, for a moment, and it's something that's, AA is a, it's such a remarkable organization. Its practitioners are alive and well. At the same time, Reverend, there's an awful lot of people who won't go to a meeting, who won't do the things. Seats are too hard. I've heard it all before, on and on. There are people dying all around us. I was in and out of AA. People took me to AA for 9 years. And I never could stay sober because I always had reasons why not. And there's a great many people out there dying. I see people die today from alcoholism as part of my work. And I have an answer for them. And the people around me have an answer for them. But they will not listen. And they take a little different refuge than they take from the church, I suppose. In the church, they have a little different reason. In alcoholism, the reason, or the treatment of alcoholism, the reason always gets back to this. My case is different. I'm not like those people. I am different. And that is really, to me, the lethal thing that causes alcoholics to die. When you stop and think about it, you know, AA's been around 60 years, and incidentally, in passing, I want to, I haven't been down here since the convention in July. And that really was run very well. You people down here did a good job of that. Bonnie, I know, worked very hard on it. And a lot of you people in this room worked on it. And it was a great time for many of us. I think I was able to participate in the only meeting that they called the police to. But I don't carry grudges, and I don't. I just said, "You'll never take me alive, copper." That was a great, great affair. But those thousands of people, those 55,000 people gathered here, manifesting great enthusiasm, and I. About the only religious convocation you see like that, I suppose, is sometimes at St. Peter's when a group forms to hear the Pope, or sometimes in these, is it the Seventh-day Adventists that where they have such large conventions? They really are enthusiastic. They really, I mean, many of us don't understand what they're doing or even agree with or understand it, but I admire them. I used to, when I was a young man, make fun of people selling the watchtower on corners. You know, think, you goof, why don't you stick a watchtower? But as I've gotten older than AA, I've come to respect those people a great deal because they're out there doing what they believe and taking the scorn and sneering from people who aren't fit to shine their shoes. And they stand there and take it and pass out the watchtower because that's what they believe. And it's a great thing. You know, the whole genesis of AA came from much that same attempt to bring about. I don't know, I don't want to get off in some, this is completely different than what I planned to say when I got here. what I was going to say is, I was going to commend Valerie, because I was over in San Marcos having a cup of coffee, and I heard a voice say, "God, make sure our speaker gets here." And I appeared in this doorway. If someone would go over to San Marcos and get my car. But you know, the genesis of AA, I'm sure the Reverend probably knows it, but came from the root of the Oxford movement. And the Oxford movement, I'm sure some of you know, some of you don't know, comes from the, it was not known as the Oxford movement. It was founded in 1912 by a Lutheran minister in Pennsylvania. And he founded it, he founded this organization to try to get Christians back into the zeal and enthusiasm that they manifested in the first century, where people were willing to die, be eaten by lions for their faith. They wouldn't recant. They'd be willing to be crucified upside down, be burned. And he didn't want that to happen, of course, but he wanted people to have that kind of zeal, that enthusiasm to be willing to persevere. And the name of the organization, which later became known as the Oxford Group, was established as the First Century Christian Association. That was the name of it. And a few years later, some practitioners took it to England, and for some reason, the people at Oxford University took it up as kind of a thing, a betterment thing, and it did so well there that it gradually assimilated the name the Oxford Movement and came to be known as the Oxford Movement. And when Bill and Dr. Bob met in 1935, by a great stroke of good fortune for you and me, that was the zenith of the Oxford Group. It wasn't ever that big before that, and it went downhill shortly after that. But at that moment, there was everywhere they went, and so they were part of a zenith. And what happened later on, of course, is that in 1938, this man who had founded it, he was getting old now, and he wanted things to be ordered. And what he saw, for example, in Germany and in Italy, that there may be dictators, but they're making things orderly. They were so disorganized before, and their countries were so bad, but at least they were operating orderly. So he got to be kind of friendly with some of the German leaders and Mussolini. And the people in England were so taken aback by this that they asked him not to use the name Oxford Group for his organization anymore. And the whole world was rearming then, so he thought, well, we're rearming too, only we're trying to do it a different way. So he changed the name of the organization to the Moral Rearmament, which became the name of it. And there's still little pockets of the Moral Rearmament movement around the country. But this genesis, the thrust of his original thrust, the thrust of all spiritual movements, how do we maintain that zeal? How do we maintain that energy? How do we get people to keep doing it? And that's why it's so frustrating, because it's, you and I have all sat in meetings where we're hearing the same things, and a person here hears it and says, yeah. And the person next to him says, what? I don't get it. I just don't get it. And it really sounds kind of funny, but it isn't funny, because they die as a result of it. They die or go mad or go crazy. Their lives are ruined. I sat in meetings again and again and again and again over a period of years. And people around me, that people I don't know that I'd hire to mow my lawn, some of them, were finding spiritual values, and people who were my bosses were finding spiritual values. And it was very nice, but it's just too trite. So it's, you know, it doesn't seem to track. Doesn't seem to track. I was raised in a very strict church, the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, a little town up in Wisconsin. And we were exposed to real, what we thought were frontline Christianity. I mean, that's all we knew. There was no hemming and hawing. There was just, this is it. And you, in looking back, they only really had two major rules, as I recall. You don't sin, and you don't monkey with Catholics. It seems reasonable if you want to go to heaven. I mean, think about it. And as I was growing up, I see in retrospect now, I didn't think it was anything to do with the church. Not the church's fault, not my fault, nobody's fault. it just turned out I was one of the few guys that needed a little more fun than most Norwegian Lutherans. Whose fault is that, you know? So I got sinning. Then I got monking with Catholics. Then I got sinning with Catholics. So I knew I was going to go to hell, but it wasn't anybody's fault. It was just one of those things. It wasn't until years later in psychoanalysis, when I was digging to the roots of my discontent, that I discovered that the Norwegian Lutheran Church had psychologically repressed me and left deep psychic scars. How would you like to find that out about your own church? If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have hired a couple codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. But I was raised in a strong church, and many people around me found what they're still there. Go to that Norwegian Lutheran church, don't go over to the other. There's still old guys there that were there when I was a little boy. And I must say that there's not quite as much laughter as you find in an AA meeting, as a rule, because there's a, and it happens some places in AA too. This does happen in AA, and it makes you want to puke. They think the word, we came here to get somber. No, we came here to get sober. Sober, not somber. Because there's a school of thought, and I think it goes back to the, some churches, some people's early experience with the churches, that the more somber you are, that indicates more spiritual you are. And you look, if you look like you swallowed a green persimmon, you just, you know that you're next to God right now. And I found God's joy and God's love. And they say the same things in AA meetings, some people. And you want to just jump up and say, why don't you tell your face? You know. Because there's a certain... Because it turns out the manifestation here we're seeking is the manifestation that Frank Buckman was looking for in 1912 and people have been looking for a thousand years. How to restate that commitment so that you live, I believe, in God's spirituality. Whether, if you may be in a situation where you're not quite into God yet, and I understand that, because when I came to AA, I could not accept God because of my own belief over so many years that I was so bad, and I had been bad. I remember when I was new telling someone, and my sponsor, I guess, that I have broken all 10 commandments. All 10 commandments. And that doesn't leave you much room to maneuver. But later I happen to remember I haven't broken all 10 commandments. I've never coveted my neighbor's manservant. Which isn't a hell of a lot, but at least it's a beachhead, then you can move from there. But when I came to AA, like many people, I could not accept the concept of God, nor could I for a long time before that. I went to meetings several times around the country in my slipping years, and could get along for a little while, as long as people were talking about drinking and feeling good. But sooner or later, that subject of God comes up, and that's a stopper for people who secretly feel guilty and bad. And I remember one time in Chicago, this little old lady came up to me and said, you know, I heard you talk at the meeting, in discussion, you know, and I just hate to see you fight God. I just hate to see you fight God. I remember thinking, all I could do to keep from saying, well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again. Now you can just get it on the old audio portion of the set for a while. Because if God exists, I am certainly damned. I am damned. I can't accept that. In fact, I've talked about this before, but one of the reasons I've spent most of my life writing for a living, and I read a lot, and so I profess sometimes to be an imitation intellectual, and which I am. I don't have to profess to be. I'm an imitation intellectual professing to be an intellectual sometimes, but I'm not. But I've read a lot of philosophy in my time, because that's what intellectuals do. You read this and can't understand what the hell is all. You know? But of course, if people are looking, you say, how true. But one of the great reasons I like to read was Nietzsche is such an outstanding, cynical, nasty old craphead that when I stumbled onto him, I loved it. Nietzsche was just terrible. And one of his works, protagonists says, "Why are you concerned about God? God is dead. Perhaps he once existed to set the orbs at whirl. But now it's all this chaos. Natural law takes over, but there's no God. There's no God. Don't worry about God." Words to that effect. I remember reading that and thinking, boy, that's good news. You know, that is good news. That's like a letter from home with a check in it, you know. And I really enjoyed that. I did have some trepidations later when I read that he died in the insane asylum. But then I read further and discovered he wasn't really insane. He just had terminal syphilis. He wasn't crazy. He just liked a good time. I mean, I understand that. And that's a great philosophy. God is dead. They used it in the Berkeley riots in 1964 when the young folks were going to lead us out of the paths of evilness. And it's all very good, except then I discovered something else that is so distressing. They even quote Nietzsche on the wall of the Union Theological Seminary in Chicago. There's a plaque there that says, "God is dead. Signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. And beneath it, it says, "Nietzsche's dead. Signed God, 1906. You never want to read the second half of things in seminaries. It's just always bad news of some sort. But I went to AA seeking that very same seal. I'm sure many people in this room do, and many people in this room, I'm sure, have know people intimately that you would today would like to be able to give them the secret of sobriety. Because that is, we have been given the gift to share it, but we have not been given the gift to make the sharee accept it. And that's a sad, sad thing. In my work today, some of you know, I work in a downtown Skid Row area in Los Angeles. And I'm surrounded by people dying of alcoholism and going into terminal insanity from alcoholism. And my God, I get invited to talk all over for Cape Town, South Africa, and New Zealand, and Australia, and Berlin, and last year in Holland and Dublin and London, a lot of places around the world. And if I'm such a hotshot communicator, why can't I communicate with a guy who's sitting in front of me that I know and care for and would give anything to have him say a lot? And he must take refuge behind that same, he doesn't say it, but I know he says it. He means it. My case is different. I know you mean well. I know you try to help me, but my case is different. And when that wall is up there, your words just bounce right off, just like an invisible shield. And that's why we all get together again and again to try to reinforce our own belief. You know, we're not in AA to learn anything. I mean, we are when you're, I suppose, when we're new. But I haven't heard anything new in an AA meeting in 25 years that I haven't heard before. and yet I need to come here to be reinforced, the same information, the same, to be centered. And the hard problem is to, how do I communicate that to someone else? An example I've been thinking about a little bit recently, it's, I was a long-term slipper. I don't suppose there's a long-term slipper alive who eventually stayed sober a long time, as I have done, who has not looked back and thought, what was different this time? What changed this time? What was the modus vivendi that acted upon me to make it different? And I, not so much for my own information, but I wish I could get it so I could share it with people that I know that are long-term slippers who aren't going to make it, it looks like. And because I was a long-term slipper, they send people to me from around the country sometimes. I got a couple now, one guy from Wisconsin, one guy from Texas. And I wish I had some magic answer to give them and say, hey, this is it, pal. Wet birds don't fly at night. Oh, 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 oh. Or, never mind if the horse is blind, keep loading the wagon. Oh, 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 oh. I love those kind of phrases because they mean nothing, but people say, oh. And it's kind of funny, but it's not funny when you're looking at somebody's life, really. And I look back and I think, if I could just find that, and I got it, it always calls to my mind an analogy that is very similar, except that it's a little more simple, but it's the same thing. It's like when I was helping my grandsons learn to ride a bicycle, and they fell down, and they skinned their arm, and got a bloody nose, and just cried. And I would give anything if I could take those falls for them. Here, let me fall off. I know how to get my nose bloody, and I can do it well with aplomb, and I don't want you to hurt like that. But we all know that can't be done. All you can do is put it back on the bike and say, move your little legs and arms, steer, shut up. Sometimes I just drift into my sponsorial mood. Do that or you'll get drunk.
What?
But you put them on that bicycle, and I'm sure almost everyone in this room has had this experience. You do that for a while, and one moment out of nowhere that you cannot explain to anybody, you suddenly get a sense of balance. And you'll have that balance. You can ride a bicycle for the rest of your life. And you can ride a motorcycle if you know how to run it. But you cannot give that sense of balance to anybody else, no matter how much you love them. The one you love with all your life, you can't say, here's how you do it. They all got to get on their bike and move their legs and fall down. And in a much more complex but very similar way, this is the way it is with alcoholics and alcoholism. You can hear, you can find some way to stay here a little while perhaps and get a little sense, maybe I can stay sober, but I can't convey that to anybody else. And we all know that. We want it so hard to convey it. And all through the world, that's what 2,000 years of Christianity, dedicated, wonderful men trying to, with this enthusiasm, trying to give it to someone else. In all major religions, all spiritual movements, trying to give. I want you to have this. Look what I found. I found this joy, and people get trapped in rote and get trapped in ritual and get trapped in right, and they forget in that way, the same way as they forget the spirit of what they're giving, the spirit of, in the religious sake, the spirit of Christian understanding and joy and, or Mohammedan, same thing, Buddhism, the same thing. And an AA certainly is an extrapolation of these things. Sometimes we get so caught up in the way we're doing things, we forget that we're here to do what we're here to do. We are here to share our experience, strength, and hope with others. We are here to primarily remember that the purpose of the 12 steps is not to make you good. It's not to make you, as you may think from your childhood, the purpose of church to make you good. The AA is not designed to make you good. It's not a personality, make you a good personality. It is designed to little by little take introspective, self-obsessed, guilt-ridden, secretly inadequate people who, in conjunction with that, have an unnatural reaction to alcohol that solves the problems almost immediately, at least temporarily. People who cannot conceive living without alcohol because they drift back into that painful, self-obsessed terribleness, and drinking provides relief, the only relief they know. And somehow or other, we got to pass along to them, there's a way to do this. And they say, how do you do it? And you give them the 12 steps, and that doesn't mean anything. You know, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to admit that I'm a drunkard, and I'm all screwed up, and I'm going to return to God, and he's going to make me sane. Turn my life over to God. Try that some morning with a house payment. Here, God. You're going to sleep in the street. That's what happens. You're going to write things down. You wouldn't tell your psychiatrist. Or then you're going to read it to some blabbermouth. Did you know I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana? Going to ask God to make you perfect so you can be like all the people you always detested, have little thin blue lips. And I don't think I'd like to do that. That seems to be fun. Make amends to people who have been screwing you for 40 years. Here's $25 for calling the police on me that time. Hope it wasn't an inconvenience. Some more amends in case you've forgotten anything, and evaluation and intense study, prayer and meditation. Great step for guilty, suicidal people. When you go in to meditate, just have your pistol right along with you. So then if you possibly get through that, there must be some great reward on the end. Joy and love and understanding? Yeah. You're going to be allowed to drive across town and let somebody puke on your shoes. I don't think that works for people like me. My case is different. And that's the most difficult thing to overcome, because the facts we have to give them aren't acceptable to distorted perceptions. And yet that's what we got to deal with. So it always gets down to how to communicate this message. I think, you know, I think sometimes that it may be the most difficult sell in the world sometimes. Over the years, I've had maybe three or four people that I sponsor, three, I guess, die of cancer at UCLA Hospital. And I've sat in that damn cancer ward and with them and watched them die day by day. And it really is dreary. It's kind of it's just the death end of the ward, where people aren't, they don't expect to get better, the liver cancers and the advanced brain cancers and so on. And I sit there, I hate to be there, I just hate it. But it seems that's what sponsors are supposed to do. You've got to be with the bad days as well as the good. But I've sat there, and I remember sitting there and looking around this ward and thinking, you know, it really, I wonder what these people would do in this ward with this fatal disease. So I said, hey, wake up, got a deal for you. Would you give me an hour and a half or 2 hours of your time every day for a while and go someplace with me and meet some new people, drink a little coffee, have a few laughs, hear some interesting speakers, enjoy yourself? Would you do that if I could cure your cancer? They would sign over their house to you. They'd give you your cars. Take everything I got. Let me be one of them. Maybe the worst place I've ever been in that I can recall as far as psychologically is the Los Angeles County Hospital, Charity AIDS Ward. Not only are these people terminally ill, but they've been thrown away by everybody. Nobody cares about them anymore. Yeah. And you go to that ward, and there, it's neat, it's clean, but there's an aura of death and leprosy and just people with sores. And it's just hideous. And I remember standing there and thinking, what would these guys say? I said, hey, guys, got a deal for you. Would you take some actions, whether or not you believed in them? Would you write down a lot of the dirty things you never want to tell anybody? Would you surrender maybe somebody telling you what to do that you didn't really agree with? Would you maybe pray a little bit, even though you don't believe in God, and make amends to some people that you feel a little guilt with, and maybe try to help some of your fellows here? Would you do that if I could cure your AIDS? Jesus, take me. But in that same hospital, you go down two floors to the charity alcoholic ward, where the guy's laying with his liver out to here and his eyeballs yellow and his skin yellow, and he won't go to any stinking AA meeting. And it's kind of funny, except you go back next month and he's dead, and there's a new guy in the bed saying, I don't need to go to an AA meeting. Talk about there's nothing like it in the history of the world that I know of. Even narcotics addicts admit they're addicts. But alcoholics have to be different. And they have to prove they're different for a very simple reason. Because what they have isn't what they think you're talking about when you mention alcoholism. And all I have to do is look back at my own life. I am relatively bright, I'd like to think, and I hate pain as much as anybody I know. Why would I put myself through pain, the worst pain in my life, year after year after year, when there was and I was going to AA meetings intermittently, and going to therapy, and reading books, and I wanted desperately to feel better. I wasn't flagellating myself in any way. And why couldn't I get it? Why did I know I was so different? And I'm sure the reasons are not so unique to me as they are to most anybody in this room, anybody like us. Because I always knew my emotions were different. I knew my feelings were different. I knew I wasn't quite enough like other people. I knew that I got a little more fear. Some of the outstanding things I think, looked to me once upon a time, wrote a list of things that seemed to me different in me than other people. And I'm too easily frustrated. I'm frustrated a lot. I can't accept frustration very well. And I have a lot of anxiety because I worry a lot about things. And I have a lot of insecurity. The insecurity of not being sure of things. And I seem to be troubled with loneliness. I know other people get lonely, but damn it, I get lonely sometimes in the middle of crowds. I feel more comfortable in my room alone than I do in the middle of a crowd. You can't tell people at a cocktail party, how are you doing? Oh, I'm lonely. Yeah. You're goofy is what you are. And uncertainty, I've always had a lot of uncertainty. And that manifests itself most, anytime I make a major decision, I can bet within the next 24 hours, I'm going to curse myself and whip myself for doing that. I should have, I'm sure a lot of guys have had this feeling. Be in that church, and all of a sudden, just as the music starts, say, I don't want to get married. At least not quite yet. And every time you buy a car, the next day you think, Jesus, that isn't the one I wanted. And just everything, uncertainty and resentments. I've always resented a lot of people because it's unfair. I resent people who get along better than I do, and I resent and envy people above me sometimes. And I look at the people beneath me, for them I have contempt. Just the only time I ever feel equal is on my way by from one emotion to the other. And one of the great feelings that I've always worried, took me years to identify, but it's when you have all the emotions at once and they overload you and you just wind up with an empty feeling, just nothing. Just like there's a hole in your gut and the wind blows through. And there's no pleasure in anything. Just Now, a lot of people have these kind of feelings. They're known as intense neurotics. They're known as that's not crazy. Psychosis is something entirely different. Psychosis is when the brain, under such pressure, can't stand it, will give you a different perception of reality. That's what psychosis is. When you get that, you usually don't come back. We talk about people, oh, it's crazy, they're not sane, crazy. Sane. When you become psychotic, you usually stay psychotic. Now, these are emotions that grind people like me. Now, here's an amusing thing. We talk about alcoholic insanity. You think, boy, I guess most alcoholics eventually become psychotic. No, hardly any alcoholics ever become psychotic. The cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic are as scarce as hen's teeth. You say, well, Jesus, why is that? For a very simple reason. Psychotics are people who their brain, under tremendous pressure, has formed an artificial perception. Sometimes just a little, sometimes the whole thing. Alcoholics are people upon whom alcohol has an unnatural effect. What do you think that unnatural effect is? Makes you stay drunk all the time? Nah. Makes you act crazy? Some do, some don't. The hallmark of the alcoholic effect, it must almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It must almost instantly alter my relationship to my environment. It must take a person who doesn't feel like they're enough, and much of the time I feel like I'm more than enough. It takes a person like me that's full of fear and wussy, and I fight cops, and I jump off balconies, and I... It takes a person like me who's so afraid of rejection, I'm almost afraid to ask my wife to dance sometimes. When I drink, I become the rejecter, boy. Don't want to go out, baby? Don't come begging tomorrow. Now, it's pretty hard to argue with something that will do that for you. But when you stop to think about it, you know what happens to alcoholics? Alcoholics like me, and I presume like you, have the ability, without being aware of it, of being able to induce temporary psychosis. So I will not go crazy. I will stay terribly immature. I'll stay, you know, a good case can be made that your emotions stop maturing when alcohol begins to work for you, or really slows it down, because most people have to fight their way through intense conflicts and deal with things, and not me. That's more like it. And you pay a tab later, but that's later, you know. I always think one of the classic examples to me is I remember one time my wife and I in El Paso, we had little children. I was working at the university there. And household finance was on me like a set of hounds, you know. The alcoholic's friend, household finance, wherever you go, or beneficial, or whoever. My drug of choice was household. And we'd had a series of bad breaks. I'd lost some money in Juarez. Some Amazons had set upon me and stripped me and laid me on the ground, took my money, dirty snots. Anyway, we were waiting for household to call to see, because there's some question, maybe they're going to come and repossess some furniture. And when you have little children, you hate to have them repossess the baby's bed. You know, it's a little... And we were so afraid and God, I was nervous, and my wife was just so upset, and I finally had some rum. That's one thing I got into in the border. When you drink enough rum, pretty soon you understand where the word rummy comes from. I said, you want to drink a rum, Charlotte? She said, you don't need to be like you. Try to be nice to those people, and they just turn on you. But I took a couple of drinks of rum, and by the time the phone answered, I was the only one in the house prepared to answer it. you keep up this crap, I'm not going to borrow from you anymore. Nothing changes, but it looks different. And that's what makes it so difficult to convey this message. And that's why it's so much easier to develop, to work into procedures rather than carrying a message. And that's why we have to get together to remind ourselves again and again that we are going to someone to carry a message. They're not eager to hear it, and they're not going to believe it, really, because every fiber of their being says, no, you mean well, but it can't work. And that's what we have to keep plugging along at. That's why we have to maintain some degree of consistency in how we do things, because it's so easy to just say, oh, I've tried that and it doesn't work. How many people have you said, I don't try to help people. I just carry the disease, not the message. They get drunker after I'm there. And they may get there, but the thing that we often forget is this. The purpose of AA, in the final analysis, I said a little while ago, is not to make you good, is not to make you fine, is not to make you a savior of mankind. It's to take an introverted, self-obsessed person and have them take actions that force them out to live in the world. In other words, what must change here is something that science says cannot change. I must change my perception of reality, because I can't live with an alcoholic perception of reality, because it's just full of negativism. How in the world are you going to do that? Going to pray? Maybe. But I know they have a big school in the East, not a school, but a big place, where they send clergymen from all over the world who are alcoholics so that AAs can teach them how to take the 12 steps so they can go back and profess their religion without having to get drunk over it. Catholic priests, big home in Detroit. There's religious places. Well, maybe if we get to some psychoanalysis, but I know several alcoholic psychiatrists, and they had no luck at all until they came to AA. I sponsored one guy for a long time. He moved up north now, but he always referred his people with drinking habits. He said, but doctor, I can't go to AA. And he said, well, I do, you know. Oh. I always liked it when we sat in our meeting, because every once in a while you get some boob like that. I know AA means well, but I've got to talk to a psychiatrist. I said, come to our meeting. I'll sit you right next to him. You can really... But the purpose of all these things is to enable people to somehow come to believe. And that's what makes AA so valuable. As most of us know, there's only been two organizations in the history of mankind where there's been any success in the treatment of alcoholism. One in the 1840s called the Washingtonians that eventually expired, and one in 1935 to 1995 called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they are also the only two organizations in the history of the world that are comprised of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. The Washingtonians expired, by the way, because they thought they were doing so well with alcoholics they should be able to help all kinds of people. So they transferred their efforts to narcotics addicts and to politically upset people and slavery movements and so on. And in 3 years, all 250,000 members were dead, or gone, or drunk, or on the way to being dying. In fact, it was their experience and the almost death of Alcoholics Anonymous in the 1940s that made Bill Wilson study their history and study our history and write the 12 traditions. They're based on the Washingtonians, much of them, and based on our own experience. Sometimes it's kind of sad around AA because we treat the traditions as though they're just something you use to see if newcomers can pronounce autonomy. You know, here, why don't you need them? Read them, Fred. We need a laugh tonight. Anonymous, anonymous. Ha, And it's hard to remember sometimes that the 12 traditions are more valuable to AA. The 12 traditions are more valuable than the 12 steps. Because if I don't do the 12 steps, I might get drunk and die. If we don't have the 12 traditions, we'll all get drunk and die. There's no place to go. That's why you have to, in your group and my group, I must take the risk sometimes of being disliked to stand up for the maintenance of tradition. To take the only thing that's ever worked for people like us, and someone comes along who has no experience in anything and says, I want that changed, and people don't want to hurt their feelings, say, okay, we'll change it. And it's just hideous. But we have to maintain. We deal with alcoholics. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who are also narcotics addicts, realized that narcotics addicts had to be helped too. So they formed Narcotics Anonymous. People who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous and also cocaine addicts formed Cocaine Anonymous. And I know all these people. Woman who was a member of AA, also compulsive eater, formed Overeaters Anonymous. A guy named Jim Willis, a member of AA, also a gambler, formed Gamblers Anonymous. He's a good case in point. He formed Gamblers Anonymous and became very successful. He's the Bill Wilson of the Gamblers Anonymous. Anywhere you go in Gamblers Anonymous in the world, they know of Jim W. Because he's such a legendary. He was married to Sybil. Some of you don't remember Sybil, who's the longest sobriety in the world now. But what happened, he got so busy in his GA work that he really didn't have time for AA much anymore. Understandable. So they were all shocked when he got drunk and died. He died drunk, this great man, and in AGA he is still the wonderful, because nobody, he never gambled again because he did that. They identified with him, but he stopped identifying as an alcoholic, and pretty soon the specters came back and he drank again. That's why it is so important that we have to maintain our identification. That's why the tradition state. Now the third tradition, that's most commonly attacked by people who want to work around this. They say, well, since the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. That's true. It's an abbreviation of the third step in the long form, in which they abbreviate it to say that. The long form, it says, we must be sure that all who suffer from alcoholism are helped. They never guessed, for Christ's sake, that any non-alcoholics would try to sneak into AA. Yeah. Who would have thought that? Hey, maybe someday non-alcoholics will want to get in here. Yeah, I'll bet. And there's nothing wrong with people coming to open meetings. But if we're Alcoholics Anonymous, you must be now. You can be an alcoholic and everything else. In our groups, we try to recommend to people when they get up and say, my name is Fred and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Don't say that. Not because it's bad, but when you say you are making yourself different. And the difference is what we have to overcome here. Every chance you get, because doing the best you can all the time, you will always feel different, but you can reduce at least to a manageable amount. All the things you can do to fit in, that's why we volunteer, that's why we take these actions. But the whole point is this, why does AA work? Why did the Washingtonians work briefly? Because it isn't that they had any new wonderful actions. There's no new actions here in New York anymore. There's new actions in the New Testament. There are new actions. But what there is, a tenuous belief, maybe this person knows how I feel, and I'll try to do it on that basis. Maybe. Because I'll tell you, all of our lives, we've been going through lives where people come over all the time and say, I know how you feel. And deep inside, you just want to scream, no, you don't know how I feel. Nobody knows how I feel. I'm just alone. And you hang around this place long enough and you try to do these things, and someday some old fool comes over and says, I know how you feel. And you think, my God, he does know how I feel. And that is the first rope across the abyss. Then you can get another rope and a heavier rope, and one day you can have a pathway across there, and one day you can have an eight-lane highway. But you'll never have anything without that one rope. I know how you feel. And that's what we have to offer people. It's an interesting thing when they talk about those early 12-step calls where Bill and Dr. Bob called on this AA number 3 in the hospital, and I heard him talk years before, and he said, I was just afraid them fellas were going to talk to me about my drinking, and everybody in the world would talk to me about my drinking. I didn't want to hear any more about my drinking. But they talked to me about their drinking and how they felt. And I thought, my God, those are the first people that ever understood how I feel. And I was so impressed by that, I stuck with them fellas, and I've been with them ever since. And that is the message here, to help people believe, I know how you feel, not to give you data. I had enough data by the time I was 21 to keep me for 10,000 years. But I had to find something that I could believe that maybe somebody knew where I was coming from. And that's the gift we've been given. And we get so caught up sometimes in failing to do it, we're so eager to transmit information, we forget the greatest thing we can say is, I know how you feel. I know what it's like, and here's how I know. And that is what transforms us. And then we have to keep doing it to stay here. It's an irony. Some people do these things, and they feel so much better that pretty soon they float right out the top of AA. You say, don't you go to meetings anymore? I no longer need meetings. I walk hand in hand with God, and I pretty well have it under control. Pretty hard to argue with that. But apparently one day God gives them a beer, because here they come. It has nothing to do with God. People say, why can't I trust God's information? You can. God's information, I've come to believe, is wonderful. But my transmitter is a little shaky. My receiver is a little shaky. When I was new, for example, one of the great reasons that God told me one day, he said, quit your job and punch that man in the face on the way out. I will be done, Father. In retrospect, I realized the message was, do not quit your job. I just missed the first part of the message. I have been always troubled with my receiver. I've always had to check it out with sponsors and old timers, because we all have these feelings. But that's what, to get down to the last element of this, that is the great purpose of the North County Alcoholics Anonymous office, really, just to have a place where we continue to act as a centering spot for the transmission of this information. Some central offices around the country are dismal. I think they do less good than they do harm. They peddle all kinds of adult child of alcoholic books and inner child books, and it's hard to find AA literature there, and they really true. And you call up there and you can't find out, well, I don't know where the meetings are. Well, you know, I've always got an answering service because the one in charge is gone somewhere. And I think the great thing I liked about the North Office, Sam, did, I remember the day he started it, and Bill Blake and I were talking about that, that they were so glad they found what appeared to be the best man. And for 17 years, whenever there's action to be taken in the line of AA, Sam was an AA member. He was an AA member first, a worker that office second, and something else third. But by God, you felt there was AA here. And you've watched AA grow in this area, good AA grow in this area. When I first came down here to talk 30-some years ago, this was one of the more desolate areas of AA, just a few places. There was an old club back of a liquor store over on the main street. And if you got by the liquor store, you could get into the main. And by the time you got in there, you wished you'd have stopped at the liquor store. Christ, it's such a pity. I am not judging, I'm just telling you. But over the years, a number of forces, people have gotten sober, In one era, you know, a bunch of guys, Cliff and a bunch of other guys, all got sober close together, and they all revived Pat. And Bernie and other people, Bernie started the meeting here in San Marcos years and years. Everything just up and everything going. And AA took over. And Sam, after a while, started that off and became the focal spot. And after 17 years, he stepped down. And Jenny, Miss Jenny, is doing the same thing now. And we're doing, because that's, hey, stop it. This is the applause signal. But that's what we all got to remember. That's why we gather here. I'm going to do a little bit at length about the procedures. But the reason we are here, the reason we are at AA, the reason we are at AA is to transmit the message we received. I hope, now I have a granddaughter, I think about her, she works for MTV in New York. She's an associate producer. She's very bright. She's in her mid-20s. And I just know that those bad people will make her drink someday. They're all rock and rollers. But if she does, I hope when she comes to AA, you're talking about 12 steps and not talking about their therapist and not talking about their victimization and not talking about their inner child, because this is the only thing that's ever worked for people like you and me. And that's why we have to support this office. That's why we do it with some degree of joy. And that's why we have to support one another. And that's why I have to sit in these meetings, even though you don't hear anything new. Because somebody's sitting there, coming in, looking at you, thinking, Jesus, maybe he does know. Just the same way someone sat there for you and I when we came in. And what changed my life was I finally felt bad enough to take these actions. I could not accept them, but the pain was sufficient, so I took the actions and my life changed. I'm sure that's true with you. Because we all get, with this office, with all we do here, it all gets down to this one thing. It's a continuing action, the action of survival, the action of belief, the action of transmission of self. We're not here to become wonderful. We are here to become balanced emotionally, little by little. I know that some very important, from very nice people, just to get off the seriousness for a moment, some very nice people know this, and they would prefer to go to the football game today. I have told Margie B that the next time she has a depression, she should call Natrone Means. Now she'll get out my old doll again and her pin, and I'll pay for it all week. All I'm saying in closing is this. I very much enjoyed what the Reverend said, and I understand exactly what he says. I wish them well. But AA isn't as wonderful as it seems. It is, in a sense, but it's made up of human beings, and some won't accept it. Today in America, where there's more recovery than any place in the world, it is estimated 95% of alcoholics still die drunk. And there's no need for any of it. But that's the nature of the beast we fight. And that's why if you can get your own beast under some control, you better keep it under control. Because if it gets loose again, you and I are dead. Because the bottom line is this. In the central office, the North County Central Office, in your meetings tonight, wherever I am, Alcoholics Anonymous is exactly the same today as it was in Akron, Ohio, June 10th, 1935. It isn't this book, it isn't meetings, it isn't steps, none of these things. These things all came along later. What Alcoholics Anonymous is at the bottom line, one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that happens, the miracle starts. And it's up to you and I to make sure that it's sustained in others, but most importantly, in ourselves. Thank you.